Part 3. The Discipline of Assent. How to React to Situations. Chapter 11. On Death and Suicide. I must die, must I? If at once, then I am dying. If soon, I dine now, as it is time for dinner, and afterwards, when the time comes, I will die. Epictetus. Discourses. Book 1. Chapter 1. The ancient Stoics were very concerned with death. Actually, concerned is precisely the wrong word. They were aware of death and of the importance that human beings attach to it, but they developed a very unusual and empowering view of it. I must confess that I have had long and hard conversations with Epictetus about this topic. The thought of death used to bother me deeply. Indeed, there was a time in my life when I was thinking about it almost every day, and on some days, more than once. I don't want you to get the impression that I was ever the brooding type, prone to depressive thoughts. On the contrary, I've always been reasonably optimistic about life, enjoying or doing my best with whatever fortune sends my way. And she has sent a lot, thankfully. Moreover, I am a biologist. I know that death is a natural occurrence, the result of the particular evolutionary pathway taken by our ancestors eons ago. If we were bacteria, for instance, we wouldn't die of old age, only of accidents. Then again, we wouldn't be able to develop philosophies of life either. Still, the thought of my consciousness one day ceasing to exist did upset me. Things started to change when I first read Epictetus's statement at the beginning of this chapter. I laughed out loud and thought, what an unbelievably lighthearted attitude toward what most people think is the most dreadful thing of all. Epictetus also explained to me why I was so bothered. Why does a spike of wheat grow? Is it not that it may ripen in the sun? And if it is ripened, is it not that it may be reaped? For is it not a thing apart? If it had feelings then, ought it to pray never to be reaped at any time? But this is a curse upon wheat, to pray that it should never be reaped. In like manner, know that you are cursing men when you pray for them not to die. It is like a prayer not to be ripened, not to be reaped. But we men, being creatures whose fate it is to be reaped, are also made aware of this very fact, that we are destined for reaping, and so we are angry, for we do not know who we are, nor have we studied human things, as those who are skilled in horse study the concerns of horses. This is an intriguing passage. Epictetus sets forth three interlinked ideas. To begin with, we are no different from other living beings. Like the wheat whose spikes are destined to ripen in the sun, we too are destined for reaping. The Stoics took destiny more literally than many of us do today, since they believed in some sort of cosmic providence. But even from a thoroughly modern scientific point of view, we can see that we are one of millions of living species on one of what are probably billions of habitable planets in the universe. The second point Epictetus makes is crucial. We are so distraught about the prospect of our own death precisely because, unlike wheat and most other species on Earth, presumably, we are capable of contemplating that thought. And yet, knowing something does not change the nature of the thing, of course. It just changes our attitude about it. This line of thought thus leads straight back to the fundamental Stoic idea of the dichotomy of control. Death itself is not under our control. It will happen one way or another. But how we think about death most definitely is under our control. That's the part we can and need to work on. This second point leads to the third one. The analogy between studying human affairs and, of all things, studying horses. Epictetus is reminding us that if we are afraid of death, then it is out of ignorance. If we knew or truly understood more about the human condition, as a horse trainer knows and understands horses, then we wouldn't react the way we do to the prospect of our own death. Epictetus sensed that I wasn't quite convinced. So he changed tactics, as any good teacher does when faced with a promising student, who nevertheless just refuses to see an important point. Will you realize once for all that it is not death that is the source of all man's evils and of a mean and cowardly spirit, but rather the fear of death? Against this fear, then, I would have you discipline yourself. To this, let all your reasonings, your lectures, and your trainings be directed, and then you will know that only so do men achieve their freedom. This is an idea also taken up by other Stoics like Seneca, and by later figures influenced by Stoicism, such as Montaigne. If there is one thing that philosophy ought to be good for, it is to make us better understand the human condition by showing us not only how to live our best, but to accept the fact that death is nothing to be afraid of. Even the Stoics' arch rivals, the Epicureans, thoroughly agreed. As the founder of their school wrote in his Letter to Minicius, "Death, therefore, the most awful of evils, is nothing to us, seeing that when we are, death is not come, and when death is come, we are not." "What, then, if I fall ill?" I asked Epictetus, thinking that perhaps it isn't death, but the process of dying that is the real issue. "You shall bear illness well." "Of course, but who shall tend me?" "God and your friends." "But I shall lie on a hard bed." "But you can do it like a man." "I shall not have a proper house." "If you have one, you will be ill all the same." Tough teacher, isn't he? But by now, all of this makes perfect sense from within the Stoic framework, right? It is a fact of life that we are stricken by illnesses. And for most of us, one of them will eventually kill us. And we ought to consider ourselves lucky if we do have friends or loved ones nearby. It will mean that we have been decent enough people to maintain such ties with the rest of humanity. Those around us cannot cure our illness or save us from death, but they can accompany us part of the way, comforting us before we get there. And of course, it would be better to end our journey in a proper house and on a soft bed, but really, compared to what will be happening and should be absorbing our full attention, those are minor details. "So inevitably, the time will come to die," I continued. "What do you mean by die?" Epictetus corrected me. "Do not use fine words, but state the facts as they are. Now is the time for your material part to be restored to the elements of which it was composed." "What is there dreadful in that? What loss to the universe will this mean? What strange or irrational event?" Again, the reassuring voice of calm reason. Again, the invitation to take a broader perspective on things rather than be focused on one's own self. The astronomer Carl Sagan, one of my scientific role models when I was a kid, invited us to reflect on the fact that we literally are stardust. The chemical elements of which we are made originated after the explosion of a supernova somewhere in the neighborhood of the solar system, and billions of years of evolution later, such matter became the very molecules that constitute our bodies. It is a wonderful, awe-inspiring thought. But the converse of that is what Epictetus is getting at. We will, again literally, return to dust, recycling our chemicals, allowing new living beings to take our place in the workings of the universe. It doesn't matter whether those workings have a point or whether they are just what they are. Either way, we came from cosmic dust, and we will return to cosmic dust. If anything, this should make us even more appreciative of the infinitesimal interval from a cosmic perspective, during which we are alive and we eat, drink, and love. Regret at the anticipation that this interval will end is not just irrational, but entirely unhelpful. And yet, some people are not persuaded of this at all. On the contrary, a number of techno-optimists think that death is a disease that should be cured, and they are investing good money in the effort. Broadly speaking, they call themselves transhumanists, and quite a few of them can be found among the white male millionaires in Silicon Valley, where many of the world's most influential tech companies are located. Perhaps the most famous and influential of the bunch is Ray Kurzweil, a futurist, someone who thinks he can study and predict the future, currently working at Google to develop a software capable of understanding natural language. Kurzweil has a number of important achievements under his belt, including the development of the first OmniFont optical character recognition system. age 68 at the time of this writing, he has been arguing for some time that the way to immortality will be to upload our consciousness into a computer, which he claims will be possible any day now. Indeed, we better manage that feat before the so-called singularity, a term invented by the mathematician Stanislaw Ulam to describe the moment when computers will outsmart people and begin to drive technological progress independently and even perhaps in spite of humanity itself. This is not the place to explain why I think the whole idea of a singularity is predicated on a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of intelligence, or why uploading our consciousness to a computer is extremely unlikely to ever be possible, since consciousness is neither a thing nor a piece of software. Here, I'm more interested in the chutzpah displayed by people like Kurzweil, as well as by his almost cult-like following, who think of themselves as so important that they ought to, godlike, transcend the laws of nature itself, never mind the fact that they are spending inordinate amounts of money and energy that could be directed toward ameliorating actual urgent problems the world faces right now, or the disastrous ethical and environmental consequences of their success, if it were possible. Who exactly would have access to the new technology, and at what price? If we succeed in becoming physically immortal, the alternative to uploading hoped for by some transhumanists, will we keep having children? If so, how would an already diseased planet sustain the thirst for natural resources of a population that grows so relentlessly and manage its ever-escalating production of waste products? Ah, but we will expand beyond Earth. We shall colonize other worlds. Never mind that we still don't know of any other habitable worlds in the galaxy, or that we have no clue about how to get to them if they're out there. The more I think about transhumanism, the more the word hubris, famously invented by the Greeks precisely for such thinking, seems awfully appropriate. The likes of Kurzweil simply don't want to leave the party, it seems to me, no matter what the cost and regardless of how privileged they have been while attending it. Which is why I imagine him having this conversation with Epictetus. No, I wanted to go on feasting. Yes, those at the Mysteries too want to go on with the ceremony, and those at Olympia to see fresh competitors, but the festival is at an end. Leave it and depart in a thankful and modest spirit. Make room for others. Others must come into being, even as you did, and being born must have room and dwellings and necessaries. But if the first comers do not retire, what is left for them? Why will nothing satisfy or content you? Why do you crowd the world's room? Which brings me to the second, far more delicate topic of this chapter, and one to which the Stoics devoted a lot of thought that I think is very much of relevance to us moderns. Suicide. On the weekend of July 23rd and 24th, 2016, the performance artist Betsy Davis hosted a party with 30 or so of her closest friends and family. The occasion was joyous, with people playing cello and harmonica, drinking cocktails and eating pizza, and watching one of Betsy's favorite movies, The Dance of Reality. A bit before sunset on Sunday, the guests left, and Betsy watched the sunset on her wraparound porch. Shortly after, in the presence of her caretaker, her doctor, her massage therapist, and her sister, Betsy took a cocktail of morphine, pentobarbital, and chloral hydrate prescribed by her doctor and died peacefully. You see, Betsy was suffering from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. She had almost completely lost control of her muscles. At 41, she not only was unable to perform, but could no longer brush her teeth or scratch an itch, let alone stand. Her speech was slurred and had to be translated to others. She took the dignified way out, thanks to the recently enacted California law on assisted suicide. Hers was a beautiful, heart-wrenching story, which I related to Epictetus. If it is not to your profit, the door stands open. If it is to your profit, bear it. For in every event, the door must stand open, and then we have no trouble, he calmly replied. The open door, was the standard phrase he used with his students whenever he wanted to talk about suicide. Seeing my puzzlement, he elaborated. Suppose someone made the room smoke. If the smoke is moderate, I will stay. If excessive, I go out. For one must remember and hold fast to this, that the door is open. The order comes, do not dwell in Nicopolis. I will not. Nor in Athens. I give up Athens. Nor in Rome. I give up Rome. Dwell in Gyara. I dwell in Gyara. But this seems to me a very smoky room indeed, and I depart where no one shall hinder me from dwelling, for that dwelling is open to every man. Before we examine this more closely, allow me to insert an interesting historical parenthesis about Gyara. Apparently, the place where Epictetus thought one might have a hard enough time standing to actually consider walking through the open door. Gyara is a small Greek island in the Cyclades to which the ancient Romans exiled troublemakers. One such troublemaker was none other than Musonius Rufus, Epictetus's teacher, who was sent there by the emperor Nero for allegedly participating in the Pisonian conspiracy, a charge unlikely to have been true. That was the second time Musonius was sent into exile. The practice of sending exiles to the island, which is apparently pretty arid, was later resurrected by the military junta that controlled Greece from 1967 to 1974. This time, it was leftist intellectuals who played the part of the Stoics. About 22,000 of them were sent there. However bad the conditions are on Gyara, it must be said that Musonius may have been tougher than even Epictetus, since he didn't choose the open door, but rather waited on the island until he was recalled to Rome. Getting back to Epictetus, there are a number of important things to notice in the passage just quoted. To begin with, he very clearly states that deciding whether or not to walk through the door is a matter of personal judgment pertinent to specific situations. If the situation is truly unbearable for you, then you have the option to leave. Second, and crucially, the door must stand open, and then we will have no trouble. What will make it possible for us to withstand harsh conditions and very difficult periods in our lives will be precisely that we always have an alternative course of action at our disposal. Just as, for the Stoics, death itself is what gives urgent meaning to life, the possibility of leaving life voluntarily gives us the courage to do what is right under otherwise unbearable circumstances. Finally, notice the reference to the coming of an order to leave. Scholars of Epictetus have shown that he is talking about God here, but in a very subtle way, which is once again compatible with either a religious or a secular reading. Recall that Epictetus, more so than other Stoics, believed in providence, that is, in a general plan for the cosmos. That plan, however, was not laid out by a personal God who answers prayers or is concerned with the fate of individuals. Epictetus explained the idea to me using yet another analogy. For the foot, for instance, I shall say it is natural to be clean, but if you take it as a foot and not as a detached thing, it will be fitting for it to walk in the mud and tread upon thorns and sometimes to be cut off for the sake of the whole body, or else it will cease to be a foot. We must hold exactly the same sort of view about ourselves. That explains the sense in which someone might receive a call to cut himself off the rest of the cosmic body, so to speak. But how are we to know about the call? How do we interpret the will of the universe? We make use of reason. It is therefore entirely up to us, individually, to examine the situation and decide whether we hear the call of the cosmos, so to speak, or not. It is, in other words, our own judgment that tells us whether it is time to walk through the open door or whether we should stay and fight another day. Being practical philosophers, the Stoics fine-tune their ability to make such judgments by reflecting on examples from the past, just as the story of Betsy Davis had me reflecting on disease and mortality. The very first mention of a Stoic committing suicide concerns Zeno of Cyprus, the founder of Stoicism. Diogenes Laertius, in his Lives of the Eminent Philosophers, tells a number of different stories about how Zeno died, only one of which can be true, obviously. One says that, being old, frail, and in pain, he decided that he had nothing more to contribute to society, so he starved himself to death. This may or may not have happened, but the story is significant because it introduces the idea that it is acceptable for Stoics to walk through the open door under certain circumstances, given that it is possible that the very founder of the school did it. There are several more examples from Stoic lore, but I'll mention just two of them in order to broaden our view of the topic. We have already encountered Cato the Younger, who literally tore his guts out so as not to fall into the hands of Julius Caesar. The last example is Seneca, a rather controversial figure even within Stoic circles. It is not at all clear just how much Seneca lived up to his own philosophy, given his involvement with Nero's regime. He has been portrayed as everything from a hypocritical schemer to a secular saint, with the truth likely being somewhere in the middle. He was a flawed man, as he himself repeatedly wrote, who tried his best under nearly impossible circumstances. Seneca succeeded in guiding Nero and containing the damage for the first 5 years of his reign, even if he eventually lost control of the increasingly unhinged emperor. Regardless, as mentioned earlier, he was suspected of being part of the Piconian conspiracy that sent Musonius into exile, also probably on trumped-up charges. Nero ordered Seneca to commit suicide, which he did at age 69. He could have resisted, probably in vain, tried to escape, or pleaded for his life, as many others did. Instead, he chose a dignified exit, in part to retain his integrity, and in part to preserve at least some of the family assets so that surviving relatives could inherit them. I've brought up the examples of Zeno, Cato, and Seneca with all the due historical caveats because they illustrate five different reasons for walking through the open door. Zeno did so because he was in increasingly unbearable pain, and he also felt that he had become useless to society, not very different from the case of Betsy Davis. Cato walked through the open door for principled reasons in defense of a political cause. Seneca did so as a matter of personal dignity and to safeguard the people he was leaving behind. To this list, one can add the attempted suicide of James Stockdale. Some of these reasons for committing suicide are being debated today in military, moral, and medical circles so that the Stoics still have very much to contribute to our evolving view of the world. We certainly regard as heroes those people who sacrificed their lives for the greater good, and an increasing number of countries are allowing, or at least considering, forms of assisted suicide, like the one made possible by California lawmakers to aid people who feel, as it seemed to be the case with Zeno 23 centuries ago, that they are at the end of their life. Of course, these notions are controversial, as political suicide can be as virtuous as Cato's, or Stockdale's had he succeeded, but also as horrible as that of modern-day suicide bombers. And ending our lives on our own terms is seen as empowering by some, but as a sacrilege against the sanctity of life by others. Then there is the danger that someone may commit suicide for no good reason. A Stoic rationale should never be deployed, for instance, in the case of people who are mentally ill and require aid in recovering, not in ending, their life. Similarly, there are trivial excuses to commit suicide that would most certainly not receive the approval of a Stoic. For instance, after the publication of Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther in 1774, there were a number of copycat suicides among young men who fancied themselves to be real-life versions of the story's protagonist. This led to the banning of the book in several places. In 1974, the sociologist David Phillips coined the term Werther effect to refer to the general phenomenon of so-called suicide contagion, often inspired by the suicide of celebrities, fictional or otherwise. Epictetus, ever the wise man, was aware of this danger and made it clear to me that a light attitude toward taking one's own life was not the Stoic way. Let me describe another state of mind to be found in those who hear these precepts amiss. A friend of mine, for instance, determined for no reason to starve himself. I learnt of it when he was in the third day of his fasting and went and asked him what had happened. "I have decided," said he. "Yes, but for all that, Say what it was that persuaded you. For if your decision was right, here we are at your side, ready to help you leave this life. But if your decision was against reason, then change your mind. A man must abide by his decisions. What are you doing, man? Not all decisions, but right decisions. Epictetus added, "Stay where you are, and depart not without reason."